Blog Talk Radio. Welcome back to Insight into Healing. My name is Alexa Servadio, and I am your host. Tonight, I have a great show planned for us. We've got numerous questions from the listeners, anything ranging from anxiety, cutting, conflict with our friends. So I think it's going to be a really interesting show. Let's go into our first question. Dear Insight into Healing, I feel that my anxiety has taken over my life. I am anxious in all areas of my life, but I've noticed when I'm in social settings, it is at its worst. What can I do? Well, this is a great question. I find that anxiety has become such a huge problem for a lot of people. It's one of those things people don't like to talk about it too much because it comes on so quickly. A lot of times, it takes you by surprise. You're really not sure what's going on. And, you know, I've heard a lot of times with my clients, they've actually, the first time they've had anxiety or a panic attack, they've actually gone into the hospital. They went into the emergency room feeling like they're having a heart attack or a stroke. They're really not sure what's going on. And anxiety, as I said before, can be so crippling. A lot of times my clients have described it as they feel like they're dying. They feel like they can't breathe. Their heart is racing, their hands are sweaty, their thoughts are racing all over the place, and they really cannot seem to get a control over what they're feeling. Their mood is going up and down, and just feeling really out of control. So this is an interesting question. I feel that my anxiety has taken over my life. What I've said in past shows about anxiety, usually anxiety will start in one area of your life. It might be triggered by an event. I've had someone maybe who was in a car accident, so then going in cars, going on the highway, going on certain places, kind of gets them a little spooked because, you know, they had an accident, so it almost confirms in their mind that this is dangerous. So, you know, if not addressed, every time they go into a car, they get some anxiety about, you know, will this happen again? So, but I think through time and working through that, it can be dealt with. But then I find certain people with anxiety, you know, maybe they'll say, okay, then I just won't drive in the car. Or sometimes people have insecurities about being in public transportation, so then they just don't take the bus or they just won't take the subway, so they figure that that is the best solution to their problem, and okay, I just won't take the public transportation. But what happens with anxiety, if it's not addressed, it will start in one area of your life, and then it will start festering, and it will go into all the areas of your life. So don't be alarmed. I mean, this is something I hear all the time about, that it has gone into all the different areas of my life. So this is common. This is what happens if anxiety isn't addressed. But this person said, I've noticed when I'm in social settings, it is at its worst. What can I do? I think first, let's really explore, has anything happened in a social setting? I think coming to the real basic and the real obvious, was there ever an event? Sometimes we hear all these things about going to concerts and the stage falls or there's a fight or someone gets hurt. That could be something, even if it directly did not impact you, that's something maybe subconsciously could have affected you or could have sort of started to originate the anxiety, where the anxiety came from. So number one, check if there was anything in social settings. Was it something when you were younger? Were you teased? Were you bullied? Even things that have happened in the past can show up later in life for anxiety. You know, maybe you were teased in school when you were giving a certain performance, and now what you find as an adult, you're in work, you know, giving a speech or doing a meeting, and you feel this anxiety coming up. So I think really exploring what it is, the anxiety, and I know a lot of times when it's coming or when the anxiety is happening, the clients kind of want to push it away and act like it's not happening. That's one of the worst things I feel professionally you can do. The anxiety has to be acknowledged. Like any feelings that we're going through, if we don't acknowledge it, we can shove it under the rug so many times, but then it comes out. Like how, you know, maybe this person had anxiety in smaller sections of their life, and because it was kind of pushed under the rug, now it seems to come in every area of your life. So I find I can really explore what is this anxiety about. And I think really when it's happening, you might not be able to explore exactly what you're feeling and what, you know, because your thoughts might not be too coherent. You might not be able to actually start analyzing what's going on. So what I like to do is to tell a lot of my clients to kind of have a journal and it, for the day, and it doesn't have to be long sentences or paragraphs. We're kind of saying I woke up in a good mood or I woke up feeling a little bit off. My alarm clock didn't go off on time. The dog wet the floor. I burnt the toast. And kind of set the whole day and then talk about how your lunch was. How was your drive to work? How was your workout? And kind of keep a journal and a schedule of your day. And I know it sounds a little tedious and it sounds like it could be a lot of work. But what it does is it really brings an awareness of how your day is. And if there's any type of triggers, sometimes we don't realize these triggers are happening. So it's really getting a good idea of what is your day. And then also at night before you're going to bed, kind of looking at the day and saying, okay, did I see that my anxiety was higher in the morning? Was it higher in the middle of the day? Was it higher at the end of the day? Was there certain events going on? Was it when I was alone? Was it when I was traveling? Was it when I was around other people? And really building up a huge awareness and almost kind of overanalyzing your anxiety, but not when you're going through the actual panic attack. But what later on, really overanalyzing the anxiety, because I find when we kind of keep this unknown, it becomes the fear of the unknown. So then we get anxiety about having an anxiety attack. So then we build it up to this huge, huge event that sometimes it'll be a lot bigger, what we anticipate it'll be a lot bigger than what it actually is. So we want to make sure we really explore it, we really address it, we talk about it. And if there's a close friend or family member or a therapist that you can talk to and really let somebody else know about this anxiety that you really trust, so you can really explore them, you know, what's going on. So you don't have to go through this alone. Also with anxiety, it doesn't mean you always need to go on medication. I have worked with a lot of clients who had severe anxiety to the point where I was the only person they saw. I was the only time they left the house, and that was very difficult. There was a lot of anxiety getting to my office. But as months went by, even without medication, we went over certain tasks, certain things I wanted them to do. A lot of them now are going to school. They're working. They're in relationships. So anxiety, there is hope. It's not the end of the world if you're having these severe panic attacks or severe anxiety. And I know one thing about anxiety, it feels like it's the end of the world. It feels like it's never going to get better and it's only going to get worse. This is that whole mind game. The mind is a brilliant, brilliant mechanism, but it also can really, you know, have such control over us. So it's always that I say, like, mind over matter. We kind of have to figure out what's going on with our thoughts and changing our thought patterns. As I said before in previous shows, counting back from 1,000. So it says, what can I do when I'm in social settings? Counting back from 1,000, that's something, you know, in your mind, in your head, other people won't realize what you're doing. So you can slowly start counting back from 1,000. And then if you find yourself allowing those thoughts to come in, you stop them right away. And then you have to start all the way back from 1,000. So don't let, if all of a sudden you're saying 1,000, 999, oh my God, my heart's racing, I feel nervous, go right back to 1,000. Because we really want to train your mind that it has to be able to cut off those automatic thoughts, and then we can start replacing them slowly with more positive thoughts. It'll sound strange, but the anxiety was kind of a defense mechanism, an unhealthy defense mechanism that you've used or that has been ingrained in your mind. So that takes over when you get nervous. That takes over if you get spooked or something. The anxiety happens, and it thinks it's protecting you. But what it is, it's really, you know, destroying you. It's so detrimental to your mental health. So, but we can't just rip it out of there and not replace it with anything. So we're slowly taking the negative thoughts away and slowly replacing them with more positive thoughts, more peaceful thoughts, more calming thoughts. So you build up your self-confidence and you start realizing you do have control over this. And I think a lot of it is in the beginning, even if you don't believe it, say these positive affirmations. Start counting back from 1,000. Even if you don't think this is going to work, it's never going to work, try to keep those thoughts out of your mind and, again, replace them with a positive affirmation. I would start, again, counting from back from 1,000. I would also have, if there's a positive affirmation or a Bible saying or Psalms in the Bible that help you, repeating those. We want to focus on the words and we want to focus on the numbers. We don't want to focus on our emotions. That's the most important thing. We don't want to say, okay, I'm feeling nervous, I'm feeling this, I'm getting scared. We want to keep those thoughts out. This isn't the time to analyze why you're feeling this. We'll do that afterwards when you have better control of your anxiety. But right now, we really want to kind of give you the confidence that you can start shutting it off a little bit and maybe take the rate of a 10, horrible, horrible anxiety attack, and bring it to a 9. See, I believe in small steps. I don't think we can go from 10 to 1 the first time you're going to be trying to address this anxiety attack. We can go from 10 to 9. We don't set you up for failure. We set you up for small victories. And what these small victories do is build up your self-confidence. And when you build up your self-confidence, you start reducing your anxiety. So it's really just keeping your eyes and your focus on reducing slowly the anxiety and knowing that this anxiety is temporary. This is not permanent. This is not going to be for the rest of your life. We can work on this. And I've seen numerous clients overcome their anxiety with medication and without medication. So I think to not allow your mind to go to those places where this is never going to get better. You know, I'm the only one who's going through this. Anxiety is very common. A lot of people don't talk about it because it's so hard to understand. And I think sometimes it just comes out of nowhere. People think they're going crazy. And they're like, what is this? And they're almost embarrassed, men and women, to tell somebody what they're going through because anxiety is irrational. I mean, you can sit and talk to yourself and say, this doesn't make sense. I have nothing to be anxious about. This is not going to happen. But you can tell yourself till you're blue in the face, but your emotions are irrational. They will take on kind of a mind of their own. So that's why it's using these different techniques so you can get some control over the irrational thoughts, and then you can get better confidence so you start feeling better. So again, counting back from 1,000, positive affirmations, deep breathing into the nose, out through the mouth, but making sure you're not breathing too deep that you want to pass, that you're going to pass out, so slow breathing. Some grounding exercises. I always like to close your eyes. What do I hear? What do I see? What do I smell? What do I taste? What do I feel? And really allowing yourself to explore it and to get into that and kind of push out the anxiety. It's about, what do I hear? I hear cars driving by. Well, what type of car do you think it's driving by? Is their muffler working? What color is the car? Even if you have your eyes closed, trying to put together a story so you can start taking out the anxiety and doing that. And that does not have to be quick. Usually the grounding exercises, I would do 20 to 30 minutes if you have the time, 20 to 30 minutes. And again, this is something you can do when there's, as this person does it a lot in social settings, you'll get so good at, no one will even know that you're doing it. And I was like, in the beginning, no, someone might realize that if they see you breathing heavy, they might realize that there's some anxiety. But these are all different techniques that you can use that others really won't know that you're going through the anxiety attack. Because I know a lot of my clients have had difficulty that they become even more anxious because they don't want others to know that they're having this anxiety attack. So that even fuels the anxiety even more. So definitely, please let me know how this works. And, you know, write back to us. And I think anxiety comes in stages. So at first, you know, look for going from that, if you're having like a rate of 10, the worst anxiety attack, try the first time you try to utilize these techniques, try to go down to a 9. Then try to go down to an 8. And then maybe start saying, well, maybe let me see if I can, by the time I get to 900, counting backwards, my anxiety will lower. And kind of look at it as a game. And it takes away the intensity and the anticipation of the anxiety and kind of allows you to remove yourself emotionally from the anxiety and look at it as a condition, kind of a challenge that you need to work through. So thank you so much, and please write in and keep us updated and posted about what's going on. Let's go on to our second question. Dear Insight into Healing, hello again. I have written here before, and I've gotten good feedback, so I thought I would write back for some more advice. Well, that's great. Thank you so much. I am currently in social work school, and I'm liking it so far. In September, I'm about to embark on my field work experience. I have been living on my own and enjoying that for the past year. However, my mom cannot provide the financial supports that she has been helping me with any longer, and I do have a job. The only solution for me is to move back home. My mother has controlling tendencies and behaviors which I can't stand. How can I prepare myself emotionally for living back at home until I complete 2 years of fieldwork? Please note that I may not be able to work given my fieldwork hours with my current job. I don't know what to do. How do I set up appropriate boundaries and do not engage in conversation with my mom as much? Please help. Thank you so much. Well, first, I just want to say congratulations on going to social work school. And I remember starting my first fieldwork experience. And that alone can be a little anxiety producing. So I think, you know, that's also something that kind of fuels some of this and might be getting you nervous. And then also moving back in with your mom. And, you know, that happens so much for students, older students, younger students, going back to school students, that the cost of school and work, sometimes having your own place is too much and you can't. So, you know, this I hear a lot, that people having to move back in with their parents after they've had time on their own, had their own place. And that, I think also, it can be a hard transition. But I think this, to look at it is what it is. And I think also looking at the bigger picture, you're doing this for your future. And yes, 2 years can seem like a long time, 2 years of field work, but you never know. And I think we don't put kind of, this is what it's going to be, this is the whole timeline. Look at it, yes, you have 2 years of field work, but we don't know how long exactly you're going to have to stay living back with your mother. You know, kind of have it as an open-ended question in your mind. And he said she's been helping you financially with some of the support with living in your own apartment and that you have a job. And it's hard. I know living in your own place and working sometimes isn't enough to pay the bills. And then when you start field work, a lot of the times, sometimes you don't get paid. It's not a paid internship, a paid field work. But first, I would actually speak to your supervisor at school or your supervisor at the field work. I would start with the school first, the person who's actually setting up the field work for you, and maybe, you know, explore this with them. Because you're not the first person that I've heard that has had these difficulties. So I would ask your supervisor at school, listen, is there any way you can be compensated at your field work? Because, you know, I think it is, you do have a job. And you're saying because of your hours at your field work and the hours at your current job, you might not be able to keep your job. You know, I'm not sure the school would actually want you to stop working to not be paid, to do a, you know, kind of a non-paid internship. A lot of times when I was in school, people could stay where they're working, if this has anything to do with social work, they're not actually in the same department where they're working. They could work there, but then work in another area of that job, in another department, and that would be their field work. And they could actually get paid for it, or they wouldn't get paid for it. It depends, you know, depends on what agency or where, what your place of employment is. But I would also ask your supervisor at school about that, if that's an option, because I know that happens a lot of times. And if it is, then it's speaking to your job and saying, hey, can I still work here doing what I'm doing and then work another day or different hours doing your field placement? A lot of times this happens, so it's something, again, talk to your supervisor. And also saying, you know, if your job can't do that or it's not in a social work type of setting, maybe finding a setting where they can, you know, they can pay you a little bit. It might not be that much, but they can pay you. Or maybe, I'm not sure if you work days or if you work nights or weekends, but I think the school should be able to work around that. And maybe you can do your internship on weekends. Some places need it, especially in social work. Some people have programs on the weekends. A lot of people, you know, work, so, and they need therapy or they need social work help. They need to come at night or they need to come at the weekends. So I would definitely explore those options before you just totally, you know, give up on your job and just do this field work. I would explore those options. And then how do I prepare emotionally for living back at home for the next 2 years? Again, we're not sure if it's going to be 2 years. But emotionally, what does it mean to you to have to move back home? I think really being honest with yourself and exploring that with yourself and also with your mother. I know you said, you know, I really don't want to have engaging conversations with my mom that much. I'm not sure if you're able to engage in some conversations with your mom. But I would, before you move back in, maybe call her up and say, hey, listen, can we maybe go for lunch or maybe go to a quiet setting, you know, a neutral place to meet? and really talk about this as adults. It doesn't have to be a long, ongoing conversation, debate, or a fight. Just a really adult conversation about what you expect moving back in, what she expects, and what's realistic. And I think really being able to talk about, you know, you're an adult woman. You are going to social work school. You are working. You're going to do a field internship. You're going to have a lot on your plate for next year. So we want to make sure in some way, can we get your mom on board, if that's possible. If it's not possible and your mom's not willing to talk about it, then that's something else. But let's explore this, and then we'll go into that scenario. So I would speak to your mom and say, listen, you know, I'm going to be under a lot of pressure. I'm doing this. I know it's a tough thing, you know, for everybody that I'm moving back in. And thank you for the financial support. And, you know, it's a little upsetting. I really enjoyed living on my own. But, you know, this is what I have to do for the long haul and for my future. And then prepare yourself to be able, when you say she's controlling, I'm really saying, what does it? What type of boundaries? When you're saying setting appropriate boundaries, I think by having this conversation with her is one way to start setting those boundaries. I know it's hard to set boundaries and to maintain boundaries, especially when it comes to family members and close friends and people that you're in everyday contact with when you're living with them. But I think it's something to start in the beginning. Start right before. And I think this will be the perfect time to start doing it because you haven't moved back yet. So you can kind of give your mom an idea of what's to come. I think preparing her beforehand, preparing yourself beforehand, so then any of the stuff that kind of happens, you know, the anticipation, the anxiety, the outbursts, can kind of happen now before you move back in and can be resolved. And I think being very open about it and also saying, you know, what about your mom? What does she feel? How does she feel about you moving back in and getting her idea about it? And then with she has controlling tendencies and behaviors that you can't stand. I think also being able to kind of when your mom is telling you, you know, you should do it this way or doing that and being controlling, it's being able to kind of maybe say nicely to her because you don't want to get into a big argument or a debate. You know, this is how it is. I know it's tough for everybody that I'm moving back in, but, you know, in order for me to be the best I can be, in order for me to be an adult woman, this is what I need to do. And it's something, you know, it's hard, but I think it's something you can't kind of slack on. Once you move in, there's going to be certain things. I mean, then it's also you taking on the adult role back moving in, because then sometimes I think it can be so easy moving back into your with your parents, and then, you know, will she be making your meals? Will she be washing your clothes? Will she be cleaning? I think that's something that's really important, too, and I think maybe even talking to her saying, you know, are you going to be viewing her? Would you like to view her as your landlord? Will you be paying her something? Will you say, you know, I'll be cleaning my own room. I'll be doing all of this. So she does not have kind of the access to be controlling and tendencies to kind of be in your life at every area of cleaning your room, making your food, what time do you get up, what are you doing this. So you might want to set those boundaries and say, you know, I'm going to do this, 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 and this. This is the contract. Even maybe writing up like a very informal contract and kind of put up so you both of you know what you're expecting. And I think that's why I know it's hard sometimes to talk to people who are controlling or who people are hard to communicate with and that kind of only see it on one way. But I think for you, for your own self-being and for your own health, I think it's important for you to be able to kind of stand up to her. And it doesn't have to be an argument. It doesn't have to be screaming. We don't want that. But stand up to her and kind of start setting those boundaries. Because, I mean, we never know. You might be pleasantly surprised. Your mom might actually react in a great way. So I think that's what's really important. But I would start the conversation now. I would also start writing down what were those controlling tendencies and behaviors which you couldn't stand. Are there any ones that, you know, aren't that bad? What are the deal breakers? What are the ones that can't happen? And I think having some, you know, some parents, they can be a little controlling. They can be a little too much into our business. How much of that is normal parenting and how much is that crossing the boundaries? And I think really exploring that with yourself, writing it down, what is stuff that you can deal with and what is stuff is a total deal breaker? And I think picking your battles. What is something that you can set up and say, listen, this really can't happen. I really can't deal with these type of things. You know, this is what we have to work on. And what are things that, you know, you can kind of let slide under the rug that won't really cause a lot of problems for you. But I think look at this. I think also that this is not the end of the world that you have to move back in. You have many options. I think always keeping your options open and never kind of close it into like one thing that this is it. It's never going to be anything else. Don't set yourself up like that. This is a great experience. I mean, who knows what happens with the fieldwork experience? You might get paid. You might be able to stay in your apartment. But if not, I think it's really talking with your mom and saying, this is what's going on. And let's get to the point where it's the other scenario, if she can't talk, if she's one of those people who, you know, you can't have this conversation with without her blowing up, and it's going to turn into a huge, huge argument and cause a lot of more stress for you. I think it's setting very small boundaries with her. And then also, it's tough, but to be able to kind of tune her out when she gets into those moods, or kind of start really being aware of what her triggers are, and staying and avoiding them and staying away. I mean, one good thing is you're going to be out of the house a lot between school and if you're still working and your field work. So, I mean, that's a positive to look at. You're not going to be in the house as much as you would probably as years ago when you did live with your mom. You're going to be out of the house more, so you won't be having the same interaction. So I think it's, you know, talking to her about what her expectations are, what your expectations are, and what are realistic expectations that both of you can agree on, and then moving on from there. So please have this conversation with your mother, if or not, and please start working on these boundaries. And if you come up with a list of boundaries or a list of topics that you'd want to explore with her, if you would like to kind of bounce them off with myself and on the show, please feel free to do it. Please, you know, you can send any questions, as you know, to insightintohealing@gmail.com. And I would love to answer them, and good luck with everything. And, you know, your future is bright, and I think really looking at the bigger picture, it's going to be really, this is an amazing experience, and the world is really opening up everything to you. And I think just taking a step back and really looking about what's going on and being excited about the great work and your amazing accomplishments. This is going to take us into our first song, is The Afters, Lift Me Up.